Oh, that's right. Good afternoon, everybody. Hey, I have a real treasure sitting across from me at the table here today. I have Dr. Beth Bethel. She, of course, was a Lander professor. She currently has really gotten back into golf. She writes a blog. She writes, you write for a golf magazine. You
I
still
do.
doing that?
Well, I went back to it. You know, I quit for a while, but now I'm
Okay.
back.
She's back. She's got new knees. She's been out on the golf course for the first time today, and she played 14 holes. So I got to say, how you doing, Dr. Beth Bethel?
I am great.
Good.
Absolutely great. The weather's good. My knees are good. My golf swing's okay. Not good, but
Well,
okay.
you look good, Beth. You
Thank
look
you.
you've lost some weight and you look energized. And the last time I saw you were getting ready to have this knee surgery and
And I was a little worried about it.
Yeah, you were.
I thought I might die before I woke up.
Well, thank God you didn't. Thank God you didn't. So, I think a lot of people know you as the golfer and the retired Lander professor, and the museum is getting ready to do an exhibit on Promised Land. And there was a line in there about a book that was written, A Century of Life in a Negro Community by Dr. Elizabeth R. Bethel. And it reminded me that you and I sat down and talked about this book several years ago,
Yes, we did.
and we should sit down and revisit it because you know what? I don't think that a lot of things would have come about if it hadn't been for, I'm going to say it, a white girl from the Midwest who became a professor, assistant sociology professor at Lander, ended up down there in Promised Land talking to all these black people. And they talked to her, and she was able to write quite a book. So I wanted to talk about how this all came together, Dr. Beth Bethel.
Let's talk first about how I found out about Promised Land, because it's not the kind of place that's on the map, although thanks to Edith Childs, it is now on the map. I mean,
Exactly.
and Edith has done really a splendid job of bringing a public awareness into focus on this community that's really quite wonderful. But in 1974, it wasn't on the map. It was kind of a local secret. And I had I when
How did you get to Greenwood? First off, how did you get to Greenwood?
well, I drew a circle around Tulsa, Oklahoma, that represented 500 miles, and I said, I will take any job outside that circle.
You wanted to be outside the circle, not inside the circle.
Outside the circle, I wanted to be far enough away from Tulsa that people would not come for Sunday dinner.
Okay.
I
I
had
won't ask you why that was, Beth. We'll just move on from there.
three job offers.
Okay.
One of them was in Washington State. It was
Good.
raining.
It's cold.
cold and rainy.
Yes.
One of them was at UCLA,
Oh.
and that was the one that my advisor in graduate school wanted me to take. But I was also a single mom, and I couldn't see raising my kids in LA. I mean, I knew that I had a challenge in front of me. I had two sons, and I was going to raise them alone.
Right.
And then I came to Greenwood, and the azaleas were in bloom, the dogwoods were in bloom. It was March. You know what this place looks like? It
Right.
looks like the Garden of Eden.
Yep. Oh, there's an
It
awe
was
moment. There
like
you go.
that. It was like that. And I said, if I could live in a southern mansion, I'd take this job. And it wasn't 24 hours before I found a house for rent across the street from the Baptist Church on Gray Street. Angel Adams owned that house, and she said she'd rent it to me for $125 a month. Biggest place. I mean, it was the Southern Mansion.
Right.
And I thought,
You
it's.
died and gone to heaven.
I died and gone to heaven. I was going to. Now, I didn't bother to ask if the thing had heat.
Heat, running water, things like
It had
that.
running water, but the heat was problematic, and but that's how I got to Greenwood.
Wow. So you were an assistant sociology professor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had lots of students, and they did lots of things, and I gave an assignment. My students read a book about a commune in Virginia.
Oh, my God. A commune in the mid-70s.
In the mid-70s.
You were a rabble-rouser.
And they were supposed to compare and contrast the place where they grew up to life in this commune. Mm-hmm. And one of them, named Bernard White, Hi, Bernard.
Yes.
Bernard likes to take credit for having introduced me to Promised Land.
Okay. We should give him the credit.
Well, I'm giving it to him. Yes. I'm telling him right now, I should have given you an A, Bernard. I only gave you a C. I know. You've reminded me many times.
Okay.
Wrote an essay that said, basically, I grew up in Promised Land, and my community is just like this commune.
Just like the commune?
Just like the commune.
Well, I bet you had to go there, Beth.
I said, well, I thought he was making it up.
Right.
You know. And so I said to Betty Horn, whom you know.
Right.
Who was already at Lander and was kind of my guide to the local culture. I said, Betty, what do you know about Promised Land? And she said, oh, nobody knows much about Promised Land except it's the only place in the county where blacks can own land.
And that was in the mid-1970s.
That was 1974.
74, okay.
And now, I don't believe that that's factually true.
Right. I was just giving the context.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was a very intriguing kind of throwaway for me. And I thought, Bernard White thinks it's a commune, and Betty tells me that...
it's the only place.
And so I kind of was curious about it because, you know, we're curious about things. But you got to remember, I was very, very busy. I was starting a new job. I had to face the tenure crisis, which we all do. And I was a single mom, so I had two kids who were putting their own demands on me. And I did not have time to go scoping around the neighborhood looking for Promised Land. I had no idea where it was or anything. And then somebody told me that part of Promised Land was in Abbeville County. And I had been over in Abbeville County actually looking in wonderment at their Civil War memorial. I'd never seen such a thing. I mean, I'm from Oklahoma, you know. We have Indian stuff.
Right. Yes, okay.
and so I just kind of wandered into the clerk of court's office. And I said, do you have any land records for Promised Land, for that land out there? And the clerk of court gave me this weird look. And she said, I don't know why anybody would want to know anything about that nigger community.
Wow.
And I thought, holy moly.
Throwback time here.
Holy moly. I don't allow my children to use that word.
Right.
In fact, I told my grandmother she couldn't use that word and still be with my children.
Right.
So I was taken aback. And I pushed it a little bit and didn't get very far. But when you do something like that to a sociologist, it's just like lighting a fire under them. And so I began to kind of poke around. And the following summer, I was up at Chapel Hill, spending some time, and I was at a party. One of those academic parties. And you know what? If you've never been to an academic party, you might think they're kind of dull. But academics like to sit around and drink wine and tell each other funny stories about their worlds.
Their experiences, yes, in their world. Yeah.
And I told that story. And the room was filled with historians and social scientists.
Mid-1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they said, you need to get in your car and go back down there and find out about that place. And I did. They gave me some guidelines. I mean, this was way outside my field of training. I was trained in organizational communication, small group dynamics. I did not know anything about Promised Land or African Americans.
So you went back that from that summer,
mm-hmm.
and how did you make the first steps to get into that community? Now you were one of the things I remember from us talking before is you were very impressed for the students that came from Promised Land that were in your classes.
Those students were superior. They were disciplined. They stood out. And I didn't really understand why they stood out. But to a person, they were from Promised Land. And so I started IDing them. Mm-hmm. Isolating isn't the right word. And every time I found another student from Promised Land, I asked them, I kept a supply of really cheap cassette tape recorders. And I would say, would you be willing to, like, just interview your grandparents? And they were happy to do it. And they would bring me tapes, and I would listen. So I was beginning to collect oral histories without really...
Through the students.
Well, the students, yes.
Yes, surreptitiously, not putting yourself in there.
I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just collecting stories.
Yeah.
Trying to learn more, trying to better understand this place. It was so intriguing. I mean, friends at UNC and Duke had said, learn more. So I was learning more. And then I was in constant communication with three or four of my friends at UNC and Chapel Hill and Duke, an anthropologist, a social historian. And I'd call them up and I'd say, hey, listen to this. Listen to what I found. And I'd tell them another story. And pretty soon it became very clear that what I was finding was a treasure.
It's just like it was been sealed off from the rest of the world.
Yeah, for protective reasons.
Right.
I mean, there were good reasons it was sealed off. Then I ran into a book by Carol Blesser that was titled The Promised Land, and it was about the South Carolina Land Commission. You know, South Carolina has a progressive past, an amazingly progressive past.
Okay.
It had the only black majority Reconstruction legislature. It was the first state in the former Confederacy to mandate free common schools for all children up through the eighth grade.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This Reconstruction legislature recognized the importance of education for all children.
Wow.
Now, the fact that those schools were racially segregated is, that's anchored in historical reality. But the fact of the matter is that that group of men, and they were all men, understood that if African Americans were going to come out of slavery and take their position, achieve their position in an emerging world, they needed to be able to read and write and count. And there was a school established at Promised Land. I found the records.
Wow.
I know about the teacher.
The teacher?
The first one.
First teacher?
And the subsequent ones, yeah, because people told me about their teacher.
Yeah, but, I think part of what we need to understand is, how did you get from getting the oral histories from the students who were surreptitiously interviewing from your classes and whatnot into you actually getting to go down there? A white woman from the Midwest, Oklahoma, getting into Promised Land and having people open up to you, because that's really the whole key, is how that came to be.
They were very, very suspicious of me when I started.
Sure.
The only white people who went to Promised Land were either threatening, and those people were run off and kept out,
mm-hmm.
or they were politicians
looking for the vote,
mm-hmm. or they were potential employers. And I didn't fit any of those categories.
Now, did you start out thinking you were going to write a book?
No.
Okay.
I did not.
Right.
I was just...
collecting stories.
Yes. And it, but there came a moment when I knew I was going to write a book. The first time I got grant funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, I knew I was going to have to produce.
I guess you must have applied for this grant.
I did.
Okay, all right. So there was a thought process.
Well, there was encouragement from these people at
North Carolina
and Duke. And then the New School for Social Research got involved. And then a scholar at Maryland got involved. I mean, people got involved.
Right.
And began to say, you need some research money. You need time off. You need to do this. People saw the book before I saw the book.
Isn't that interesting?
Promised Land, the book, would never have happened without the outside academic vision that was imposed on me.
Because you didn't really know where you were going. You were not a doctor at that point.
I was.
A doctorate. You had your doctorate.
I had my doctorate, but not in this. This was an accident. It was a happy intellectual accident. So did I know I was going to write a book? No. Did other people know I was going to write a book? Yes, they did. And
because they were probably chomping at the bit, wishing they were in this situation.
They wanted this book to be written.
Yes,
This book was a, for many of them, it was an extension of work that they had done in other venues. Mm-hmm. Herb Gutman, one of the major supporters of my research, had just recently published a really important book on the Black family and slavery and freedom. Ira Berlin, another of the scholars who got involved, had written a major book on free Blacks and partial freedom. There were people who were much bigger and more prominent,
right,
that found their way into my life, and I found my way into their lives, and they guided me. It was like getting a second PhD.
That is so cool.
It was wonderful.
You know, but I'm also surprised that they didn't try to come down and take it away from you.
No. That isn't the way the academic world works.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. Because, I mean, I've heard some stories. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, this one, the world that I was involved in,
yes,
and still involved in,
yes,
is collaborative, not competitive.
That is so cool. So, before we go to the break, we've got the break coming up here in just a second. What was the deal, I got to understand, between the commune in Virginia and Promised Land that Bernard White told you that it was the same?
Well, Promised Land was composed of families, of course, in the very conventional way that
families
live in a community. It was grounded in private land ownership of adjacent tracts of land. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of collaborative.
Communal.
It was communal. The churches, and there are two in Promised Land, were built on land that was donated by community residents, right? And geographically, they're well inside the boundaries. Somebody didn't say, well, look, here, you know, I'm going to give you this piece of land out here on the edge that nobody wants. These were centrally located, and the churches are within a stone's throw of each other.
Bernard, he was being truthful when he was talking about the communal aspect of Promised Land and in Virginia.
Utterly truthful. He was truthful in the way he talked about family life and the ways in which families have a very extended and broadened notion of what it means to love. Almost like a 19th century vision.
Well, that could lead to a whole lot of questions on today, but we're not going to go there right now. We're talking about Dr. Beth Bethel, A Century of Life in a Negro Community. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about it. So don't you go away. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72 Greenwood. telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too, paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here. Gracie's really interested in what we're talking about. She's snoring over there, Beth. I'm here with Dr. Beth Bethel. We're talking about her book, Promised Land, A Century of Life in a Negro Community. And we're talking about how she got into this. And we were just at the point of talking about how she didn't know she was going to write a book about this, but she was putting all this information together. But other people knew you were going to write a book.
That's right. And they said they were giving me guidance. And so the anthropologist at Duke said, you need to start going to church. That's how
a white church?
No. One of the Promised Land churches. I said, there are two of them. Which one? And she said, both. You need to go back and forth. You need to be balanced. But that's
now wait a minute. Here is this young white gal going to a Promised Land black church, and you have two children. Did you haul your children in tow with you?
Well, one of those children in the meantime had gone to live with his father, so I was down to one child.
You're down to one. Okay.
I was down to an 11-year-old boy.
Okay. How'd that feel, Mom?
Well, you know, I said, Charlie, some of your radio listeners know Charlie Bethel.
Right.
I said, Charlie, we got to go to church. And he said, why? And I said, because I said so.
Right.
And he said, all right, because that's what 11-year-olds do.
Right.
And I said, you're going to have some proper clothes. And we're going to have to go buy you a suit. So Charlie Bethel got his first suit so we could start going to church at Promised Land. And he was cute in that suit. You know,
what kind of a suit did he have?
It was a white three-piece suit.
For an 11-year-old?
For an 11-year-old.
Okay.
And a light blue shirt and a red, white, and blue rep tie.
Charlie Bethel in a suit. That's, you know, when you think about Charlie today, that's kind of hard to believe.
It is hard to believe. It's hard to imagine. But there he was,
right,
all decked out in his little white suit, his little Colonel Sanders suit, and off we went. But
and I guess you were dressed in the appropriate attire.
I had appropriate attire, you know.
Yes, okay.
There's a secret part of me that has appropriate attire.
And okay. For those of you that know Beth now, you might be surprised, but yes, she did. In fact, I'm looking at a fantastic picture here of Beth in a off-white colored dress, yes,
yeah.
with a Elise Morton Smith. And this was in the late 1970s. You've got her arm around her, and you're smiling, and you've got pretty blonde hair, and you just look like you were having the time of your life, Beth.
Well, Elise Smith turned out to be very, very important to this, to the writing of the book and this whole story. I went to church, and Charlie and I had a very interesting experience. Mm-hmm. Although at both churches, the places were crowded, Charlie and I were seated in a pew in the center of the church by ourselves. Nobody wanted to sit with us.
And you were in the middle of the church. You weren't in the back of the church. You were in the middle of the church.
Uh-huh.
You seat yourselves?
No, we were seated by the ushers.
Okay.
And then people avoided us. And this went on for weeks. And we were riding home one day, and Charlie said, I'm not going back. And I said, why not? And he said, because I don't like the way they treat us. And I said, well, tough. We're finding out what it feels like to be treated differently and to be shunned because of our skin color. And that's something important to find out. We are going back. No more conversation. And we did. Mm-hmm. But that was a kind of an epiphany moment for me. Because I thought, these people are making me learn some important lessons, and I will learn those lessons, and we will get through this.
Now, fast forward just a little bit, because how long was it before you started being I'll use the word accepted some.
Well, at some point, maybe 8 weeks into this church thing, this short little woman, a little bit older than me, mm-hmm. came and sat down in the pew with us. She didn't say anything, mm-hmm. but she sat down in the pew with us, and suddenly we weren't alone.
Okay.
And after church, she spoke with me.
Okay.
Why are you here?
She would have been sent in as the sacrificial lamb to find out why you guys were there.
She was the spy.
The spy, okay. She's been sacrificed to go up, okay, to the spy.
She was doing their research.
Yes.
As I was doing mine.
Okay.
And we became friends.
And who was that?
That was Elise Smith.
Okay.
There she is.
The lady that you're standing there with.
And here's Charlie with her.
Wow, she was short.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And just absolutely marvelous. And Elise comes from a large Promised Land family, and her daughter, Ellistine, was Derek Butler's secretary at his local office.
Okay.
And Ellistine's husband, Neil, mm-hmm. is important to all this because Neil was monitoring me.
He was monitoring you?
Yeah, he was a young guy in bell bottoms at this point in an afro.
But 1970s, folks. Yeah, there you
but
go.
But he was a community leader. He was a young, emerging community leader. Kind of think Tom Cotton.
Okay.
Neil was a black Tom Cotton.
Okay, that's good. That's a good description.
And so he sent his mother-in-law. After he determined that I wasn't there to get their vote, I wasn't there to hire a housekeeper, and wasn't there to do something nefarious.
Right.
He sent his mother-in-law in, and she sat down in the pew with us.
Wow.
And things began to unfold.
So what did you tell her when she said, why are you here?
I said, I'm here because I want to write a book about Promised Land.
And she said?
You do. And, you know, she started helping me do interviews.
So she was positive to the fact, instead of looking at it as it could be something negative that you were trying to unleash or find out or whatever.
The people from Promised Land, the people who grew up there, mm-hmm. who have deep, deep roots there, mm-hmm. know how special that community is. They understand the historical significance of it. They may not have known all the historical facts.
Right.
But they understood intuitively the historical significance of having a community that was immune to white racism, mm-hmm. Grounded in literacy, mm-hmm. competence, hard work. I mean, if you ran the virtues of Americana down the list, you would find all of those in play in Promised Land in 1970.
Wow.
And the people who lived there got it. And they thought it was a good idea to write a book.
Let's see. 1970, things were kind of falling apart in a lot of aspects.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
You know, let me fast forward 2 years, 3 years after Elise and I had that conversation. Because one of the ways that she got people to talk to me is she bullied them. She'd say, Beth is writing a book and she's got to have something to put in it. Now sit down and start talking.
You know, and yet she was the person that came up and said to you, what are you doing here?
Yeah,
and was the first one to sit down with.
She bought into it. She bought into it. You know, I remember now I'd been investigated. I'd been monitored. I didn't seem to be bad.
Right.
And I kept Charlie right by my side. Charlie was an important part of all this.
What part was Charlie?
Charlie was my escort.
Your escort.
As a single white woman, I was a threat to both men and women in Promised Land. But I was a single mom with a kid. Charlie was never far from me. And we worked together.
Now, tell us how, just because this is kind of an interesting aside, tell us what Charlie had to do while you were at church. You had him working.
I did. Charlie has an astonishingly good memory. He has almost a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. And I was overwhelmed by the vitality and the emotional energy of church.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys go to church in white churches before? Were you church people?
Well, I'm churched as an Episcopalian.
You're churched as Episcopalian.
High church.
High church, okay.
Incense and bells and shit.
Okay. All right. Just checking, you know. Okay.
And this was, and we settled at Mount Zion, the AME church, in part because the liturgy was so close to the liturgy that I knew.
Okay.
So it was a little bit more culturally comfortable for me than the Baptist church. And don't mistake what I'm saying.
Right.
The Baptist church is a great church. I loved Crossroads. I still love Crossroads. I don't have anything against Baptists.
Right.
But it just
was more comfortable.
The liturgy was familiar.
Right.
And, you know, when people ask me today, when they ask you the great question that they ask you in Greenwood, what is your church home?
Right.
I always say Mount Zion AME Church. And I've made arrangements for my cremains to be tucked in the cemetery out behind the church. Neil's going to take care of it.
Okay.
Because that is now my church home. That is where I feel spiritually grounded.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, it was one of the many transformative moments in my life when I realized that I had found a spirituality that was personally meaningful in a way that I'd never experienced before. But that was part of me becoming a part of the community.
Sure.
And, you know, you can't write about something if you don't you have to give a part of yourself to it to get something back. And so that was... But I wanted
Charlie,
to,
yes.
Charlie, what's, Charlie. Yes. Charlie had to keep track of things. He had to keep...
Yeah, you couldn't be sitting there writing this all down.
I couldn't take notes.
Right, okay. In church, that would have been bad. Yes.
But Charlie could keep track of the number of times the collection plate was passed and for what reasons. He could keep track of the number of people who presented themselves at the altar rail. Mm-hmm. Charlie could keep track of how many people were on the deacon's bench, who was there and who wasn't there. Charlie was able to fully report. And so after church, and, you know, church went on for a while. And church was, one of the things about Episcopalians is that they get out in time to get to lunch at the country club. But at Promised Land, church goes on well past country club lunchtime. And so,
it's a long time.
Couple of hours, 3 hours, not at all unusual. One time we were at a celebration at Jacob's Chapel that went on and well past midnight.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Okay.
But that's another story. But Charlie was doing a lot of recording in his head of the details, and it made it possible for me to get that information without sacrificing my demeanor in my presence. Charlie also mapped the cemeteries. Mm-hmm. He interviewed the teenagers who certainly weren't going to talk to me.
Well, you know, and you were telling me that it wasn't long till afterwards that he would be out hanging with the teenagers after church and everything.
He did. There, Mount Zion is, I mean, there's the cemetery, and then beyond the cemetery there are woods.
Right.
And the teenagers would go out and hang out at the edge of the woods. And, of course, they were doing teenage things.
Right. And he was 12.
And
so
he was 12, so he was
almost teenage.
He was doing teenage things with the other teenagers.
Right.
What can I say? I knew it was going on, but so did all the other parents. I mean, just...
So you're gathering all this information. You're gathering all this information. Now, you brought a picture of a lady standing there that you said, now she, let's see, what'd you tell me? She was your conscience.
She is my conscience.
She is your conscience.
Mm, she is today my conscience. It's a portrait, a photographic portrait of Cora Hall, and it was taken the day that we had the publication party for the book. We had it in the church.
In the church.
Mm-hmm.
When was that? 19...
Well, when was it published?
1981.
Yeah, 81.
So you had it
Time flies when you're having fun.
I know it.
Yeah, and Cora Hall was a woman who originally didn't want to talk with me, and I bribed my way in her life, in her home.
How'd you do that?
Strawberry plants.
Oh, come on. What does strawberry plants have to do with bribing somebody?
I had a fabulous strawberry patch. I love fresh strawberries.
Okay.
And I had a really great fresh, and if you grow them, you know, they replicate themselves.
Right.
They propagate and make more, and you've got to thin them out. But I had a perfect strawberry patch, but Miss Cora Hall would not talk with me because I was a white school teacher.
Didn't somebody give you an interview?
One of my students.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the student asked Miss Hall if she would be willing to meet with me, and she said no, she would not.
She would not meet with a white school teacher.
She didn't want to talk to no white school teacher.
Okay.
And so I dug up half my strawberry bed and took it out to Miss Cora as a gift.
Okay.
Presented myself to her with my shovel and these strawberry plants and asked her where she'd like for me to plant them. And she pointed me to a really nice black loamy area, really great soil,
right.
not that nasty red clay that sticks together. I mean, this stuff was like loam, and stood over me while I planted them, pointing with her stick, this one here, this one here, this one here. And she had led me to the former chicken house and had me up to my elbows in chicken shit.
When you went there, did you go there with the idea that you would actually be planting these things?
Yeah, I was ready to do anything to get her to talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you want to talk to her particularly?
Well, she's quite elderly. She was quite elderly, and the tapes that my student had brought me led me to believe that she had some information and insights that I really wanted. Her mother was Mary Fraser, one of the members of one of the founding families, and Miss Cora's memory was quite good, you know, very, very good, and she had alluded in one of the interviews to a lynching. It was a very subtle reference to a lynching, but I wanted to know more about her mother, Mary Fraser, and I wanted to explore that lynching with her.
Is that the Andy Crawford?
It's the Andy Crawford lynching. Her mother witnessed it. And there are some guidelines in oral history. So I basically had Miss Cora's memory of what her mother had told her.
Now, but you didn't just get... So you took the strawberry plants down there. You planted them in this beautiful loamy soil. You had to be... nasty hands and all this kind of stuff.
I was pretty dirty when it was over.
Okay.
And I asked her if I could wash my hands.
Okay.
And she lived in a very small house with no electricity and no running water. It was heated by a wood stove in the middle of the room. Very few furnishings.
Two
rocking chairs and a bed, kitchen counter. Miss Cora was a woman of incredible dignity and integrity. Mm-hmm. And having humiliated me the way she did, and she did humiliate me, mm-hmm. she had me down on my hands and knees in a pile of chicken shit. She couldn't very well turn down my request to wash my hands.
Right.
I mean, Just
that's human decency.
It's human decency, and she was a woman of great decency. And so she took me into her house, and I plopped down in a rocking chair. She heated some water on the wood stove in a basin. Mm-hmm. And I washed my hands, and we began to talk.
But you told me that she carved a little bit mm-hmm. of the soap off of the bar of soap mm-hmm. and put it in there.
Yeah.
She didn't hand you the bar of soap.
No, she didn't hand me the bar of soap. And when she handed me something to dry my hands on, it was basically a terry cloth rag. A torn up piece of a towel.
And that's all she had.
She gave me what she had, and I came to admire her enormously. So she...
But you sat down in a chair. You did take a little... you went ahead and just sat down, took some liberties there.
I did. I took some liberties because I figured I'd earned the right. And I wasn't going to be thrown out, having gotten that far.
Right.
And so we... Miss Cora and I kind of had a little bit of a tension between us. Mm-hmm. Because... She was a very dominant woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, she wasn't easily backed into a corner or bullied.
Right.
And I'm
sounds like she was the bullier.
You know, she drew the line.
She drew the line. Okay.
But, you know, I'm not easily bullied either.
No, that's true.
And so we had to find our way to each other. And we did.
Well, you were sitting in the chair, and then you always traveled with your recorders.
My tape recorder. I had a little. When I think about the primitive nature of my research tools, little cassette tapes and a little cassette tape recorder and extra batteries, because you just never knew how long it was going to go on, and a portable mic.
Right.
And so I just asked her if I could turn it on. And we began to talk, and we talked about all kinds of things, you know, the sorts of things that maybe you talk about with somebody you've just met, mm-hmm. how she wanted to know about me, and I was willing to share about me. I mean, she knew about Charlie. Of course, Charlie was becoming very well known in Promised Land.
Right.
And we talked about Charlie. We talked about her children, her grandchildren. We talked about the land that she was on, how she'd come to own it. Her husband had come from Georgia. We talked about that migration back and forth. Mm-hmm. You know, we just
a good conversation between two women.
That's exactly what it was, a younger one and an older one. And eventually, not that day, but later, Miss Cora, I said, can you tell me about Andy Crawford? And she said, I can tell you what my mother told me about Andy Crawford. And she described the lynching of Andy Crawford in the most vivid detail that you can possibly imagine.
Now, who was, for our people that don't know, who was Andy Crawford?
A wealthy black Abbeville County farmer.
Okay.
And he was lynched because he didn't like the price that he was offered for his cottonseed by the white dealer.
And what time frame would that have been in?
Early 19th century.
Early 19th, okay.
Early 20th century.
Okay. And why is this significant?
It's the most infamous of the local lynchings.
Okay.
And the fact that I had an eyewitness to it was critical. You know, one of the things about Promised Land is it's a sanctuary. During the most violent times for African Americans, mm-hmm. when the red shirts were running wild, when the Wade Hampton redemption period was just slaughtering African Americans all over this part of South Carolina, Promised Land was a sanctuary.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
They were armed.
Wow.
And they stopped the red shirts at one point from coming in by telling them, no white people come in here tonight. White people come in, white people get killed. And turn them around.
Wow.
They ran the Klan off. So this lynching story, the fact that it was witnessed by...
Her mother. You're listening to WCRS in Greenwood. Go ahead.
Was a very critical part of how Promised Land operates.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, having gotten the story, I still needed to document it.
Okay.
I mean, I had an oral version of it, but I needed additional documentation as a scholar if I was going to write about it. And I wanted very much to include it in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, it illustrated a number of points. And so Charlie and I at that point were living in Durham. I'd gone to
North Carolina.
You know, I eventually reached the point where I had to leave Greenwood to finish writing the book because I was spending all my time, I was on leave, being supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities so I could write this book. But I was spending all my time sitting on people's porches in Promised Land. I couldn't unplug.
I understand. Yeah.
And so I had to leave physically.
It's like more information, more information. Yes.
And it was so much fun. And there's more iced tea to be had. And
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And I had friends. And, you know, but we were living in Durham. And I said to one of the scholars I was working with, Nell Painter, I said, "Now, how am I ever going to get any documentation on this Crawford lynching?" And she said, "Well, you know, when W.B. Du Bois was working for the NAACP, he documented all the lynchings. It was amazing what he did. So all you have to do is just go to the library and roll through 25 years of microfilm for the crisis until you find the Crawford lynching, and he'll have the details."
Wow.
And I thought, Charlie?
We could say something about slave labor, but maybe we should. I guess we should call it child labor.
So I sent Charlie to the library and instructed him on how to get the crisis, put it on the microfilm machine, and start rolling until he found the Andy Crawford lynching. And you know, I threw him out the door one Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. He took the bus down to the UNC library. I had a carrel down there where I worked. Mm-hmm. He installed himself in my carrel, and he began to work. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, the phone rang, and it was Charlie. "I found it," he said. "I found it. I found the Andy Crawford lynching." And I said, "Print it. Print it all and bring it home." And he brought home the actual documentation. And I laid it down side by side with Cora Hall's
description
and her mother's memories, and it matched perfectly.
Wow. So that's verification.
I had what I needed. All right. Now, what is this picture about? And so Miss Cora comes to the book party mm-hmm. at the church. And your audience can't see this, but you and I can see that she is very dressed up. Mm-hmm. She's quite elderly. She has huge worker's hands, mm-hmm. farm hands. She's big-bosomed. She can't stand independently anymore, so she's leaning on the pew in front of her. And she is gazing at the product of all of our work, this book. Mm-hmm. And she also, if you look at it, appears to be gazing at the photographer, which means she's looking at me when I look at her. And when I look at her, I remember the absolute critical central importance of truth. She's my conscience.
Wow.
She hangs over my desk.
It is so great that you came out here to share that with us here today. And that is so nice that you brought these pictures and the pictures of Cora there and everything. You know, Beth, as you look back on that book and everything, it's been used in classrooms. Mm-hmm. It's used as a tutorial, as a tool and everything. Could you have ever imagined going down that road?
No. No, that there came a moment. Promised Land was praying for this book. They prayed for it. They prayed for me and for the book. Mm-hmm. And I was writing, and I, you know, writers have writer block.
Right.
And I was writing one afternoon in Durham, and I thought, I don't think I can do this, because I felt such incredible pressure. Not from the scholars who were supporting me, not from the Rockefeller Foundation or from the National Endowment for the Humanities, but from the community.
Because they were depending on you.
They wanted, you know, I have a plaque at home that says that they gave me, "Thank you for writing our history."
Wow.
And so here I sat at you know, IBM Selectric. You know, I wrote this right. darn thing on it, IBM Selectric. And I couldn't.
That's a typewriter for those that don't know. An old-fashioned typewriter. There you go. Okay.
And I couldn't get the words out. I couldn't. Nothing would come. And I balled up my fists. and I slammed them onto the keyboard. And you can't do this with a computer, but you can sure do it with a typewriter.
Yeah.
I slammed them onto the keyboard in absolute frustration, and I said, God, if you want me to write this, you're going to have to help. It opened up. My mind opened up. The block was gone. And out rolled the best parts of the book.
Wow.
And when I look at it now, I don't think of it as mine.
You don't think of it as yours?
No. I read parts of it and think, I can't believe I wrote that. Because I didn't. The community wrote it.
So what effect has that had on you in today's world? And as you look at things, you say you've got Cora here as your mm-hmm. conscience. What effect did the book have on you long term?
The making of the book.
Right.
This experience, because it was kind of a long experience, mm-hmm. and the fact that the book is still in print makes it longer.
Hey, Grace. Grace, come on. Hey, this is important.
The book's in print longer than most books are in print.
Particularly for a scholarly
with footnotes.
A historical type book. Yes.
Footnotes. I mean, footnote books don't hang around this long. And what it's made me realize is that I need to stay open
to
everything. That there's a world out there. Charles Horton Cooley, who's an early sociologist, talks about the blooming, buzzing world of reality.
Blooming, buzzing world of reality. Right.
And that's what it is. It's so rich. It's so diverse. I need to stay open to that. That's what life's about.
And that happens to people, though. That's not normally the way people become in later life, do they? Don't they kind of close off some of they think they know what it is that they believe that they're not open to?
Yeah, I think people do get set in their ways, but the fact that Cora looks down on me mm-hmm. when I'm writing about golf.
Right.
And reminds me that I tell the truth.
Yes.
That I stay open.
Right.
That she had something to teach me, and so do you, and so does every other person out there. That's what this book did to me. It transformed me. Charlie and I were talking about this a year or so ago at Thanksgiving, and Wes was gone. Wes had moved to live with his dad. And so he missed Promised Land. He missed the whole experience. And we were talking at Thanksgiving. And Wes said, I guess the grandchildren said, Grandma, what was it like to write a book? And Charlie said, it was an amazing experience. We got to go places that people just don't get to go. We were allowed to enter into another world. I mean, people take drugs to do that.
Right, exactly. Well, it's not the same, but I consider I'm very lucky because I get to sit down and talk to people, and mm-hmm. I've gotten mm-hmm. to go places and do things that most people don't get to do. So I feel the same. I feel that's very blessed to be able to do these things and be part of it and to experience what other people have done, just like we've sat down here for this hour and experienced what you went through to get to be able to write this book.
But don't you think that we have that opportunity? Everybody has that opportunity.
Yes.
The people who fully realize the potential of the opportunity are the ones who almost never say, no, I can't.
Right.
And always say, let's do that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Tell me what you think.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're so right. Well, this has been absolutely a delight. It is a delight to see you so feeling so good, Beth. I've seen you through times when you haven't felt so good.
Yeah.
And to see you back being vibrant and being able to play golf and do stuff, I feel this was just so great to have you out here today.
Yeah, when you called yesterday and I thought, I don't know if I can do this. I mean, I don't know if you heard me hesitate. Because I had planned to play as much golf as I could today, and if you've had knee replacement, you know that when that's over, you go home and put ice on and collapse. Right. And I thought, my first thought was, no, I can't. And then my second thought was, oh, yes, I can.
This has been terrific. This has been terrific. They are putting together an exhibit down there at the museum about Promised Land. If you ever want to read an excellent book that really shares the whole story, you need to read the book by Beth, Promised Land, A Century of Life in a Negro Community. Still in print. I did happen to find it on Amazon. You can even download it onto your Kindle and just read it. It's still out there. That's quite a testament, Beth.
It is, isn't it?
Yes.
But it's not mine.
Well, okay. You were the spirit that channeled it.
I channeled it, but there it's not mine. It's not mine. If the community hadn't bought in,
right,
it wouldn't exist.
Well, let's just say this. You're a hell of a salesperson.
Thank you.
All right. That's going to do it for us here. This has been Dr. Beth Bethel and LRWCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.